It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you've worked in customer service, you know that putting on a happy face isn't always easy. We'll talk with a Wisconsin researcher about the challenges of emotional labor and how customers and employers can make things less stressful. First, record-breaking temperatures have hit Europe in recent weeks, leading to hundreds of deaths and worsening conditions for wildfires in southern Europe. In the U.S., triple digits are expected this week in the Plain States, with temps that could go as high as 115 degrees. Our next guest says extreme heat can have serious, even deadly effects for those of us living through it. He's with us to explain what's driving the extreme heat we're seeing, how it's connected to climate change, and what we can do about it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed more heat waves where you live? Does the heat dictate in part what you do and don't do? Have you experienced any heat-related illnesses like heat exhaustion? And if you work outside, what are the hot summer months like for you in your job? Are they getting worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Chris Uejo is an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State. He studies how the physical environment affects health and well-being. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here, Dean.
Well, temperatures in some parts of Europe are starting to cool down a bit today, but it's still really hot in other areas. And I mentioned those triple-digit temperatures expected soon here in the U.S. What do we know about what's driving all this heat right now?
Sure. So extreme heat is a widespread and pernicious problem. While in some respects, some of the same weather patterns may be promoting extreme heat across the United States and parts of Europe, there is an intensification or an amplification of some of those weather patterns that's essentially causing these periods of short and extreme intense heat to become more intense, longer lasting, geographically widespread, due to climate change.
And a 100-degree day is an occasional thing here in Wisconsin and other parts of the U.S., but Britain and France are less used to that. Can you talk about how significant the temperatures they're seeing are right now?
Sure. One way to think about it is there's a weather station that in the central part of the United Kingdom that has records going back to the 1700s, and this is by far the hottest day that they've seen. So I'm currently based in Florida, so I'm familiar with Wisconsin and did my graduate studies there. So while it may seem not that extreme to a Floridian or someone in the southern United States, to a place that is not adapted to extreme heat, something like a 40 degrees Celsius day is life-threatening and can bring some consequences, not just to human health, but closing down of airports and critical infrastructure and other cascading impacts to society.
And I'd imagine what qualifies as extreme in one area depends partly on, as you said, how well adapted a city or a country is to heat and kind of the safeguards they have in place. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So many of us think of things like, particularly here in the United States, we might initially think of access to air conditioning and cooling, but also our bodies normally physiologically adapt over the course of the summer season. So we're more, we experience the same heat exposures in, say, the end of August, we'd be more readily available to respond to that versus the beginning of May, for example. There's also adaptations such as federal regulations on safe work-to-rest ratios, how we build and design our cities, and even when it's okay to take breaks due to the extreme heat.
And what does the data tell us about how this extreme heat and the frequency of it is changing over time?
Sure, great point. So we know that pretty much across the world, the frequency of, with high confidence, the frequency of these extreme heat events, or in this case, I may call them heat waves, but these sort of short, multi-day, notably different than previous conditions of higher heat exposures are becoming more common, longer lasting, and geographically widespread, meaning covering a larger area and exposing more people. So essentially, this is just part of our trajectory, unfortunately, towards a different climate future.
We're talking with Chris Wajo right now, an associate professor at Florida State University who studies how physical environments affect health and well-being. We're talking about the heat waves we're seeing right now in Europe, hot temperatures expected across much of the U.S. this next week. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Has the high heat affected your work, what you do in your day-to-day life? Have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chris, we talked a little bit about it, but could you expand a bit on the health impacts and the physical symptoms that can come with high heat?
Sure. We're learning, and so while we understand a fair amount about extreme heat, we're learning more and more every day. And what we're finding out is extreme heat is impacting a much wider range of our health systems and our body's regular functioning than we had previously understood. So some of that is well recognized, such as our cardiovascular system. Essentially, your heart has to work harder to pump more blood to the skin to dissipate heat. Our respiratory system, your lungs, essentially breathing in hotter and humid, more humid air is more work for your lungs. Our kidney system, essentially our renal system and kidneys, their dehydration and a variety of different pathways may be impacted by extreme heat. But we're also encountering some things that we weren't as initially expected, such as mental health complications. We know that those 911 medical 911 calls for those also systematically increase across the nation during high heat periods. So both, it's more than just heat exhaustion and heat stroke, but also for those with pre-existing health conditions, there's quite a variety of those that could be exacerbated by extreme heat exposure.
And who should be most on the lookout for the effects of high heat on their physical well-being?
Great question. So everyone is at risk for extreme heat. But some groups face higher risks. So as you're mentioning, in your place that's not as well adapted like the United Kingdom, everyone faces higher risks. If you are in a place that does have some social or physiological adaptations, there's still some groups that we're most concerned about. And it's a pretty wide, they span a wide gamut of the population. Some of those include older adults, who are more likely to have pre-existing health conditions, some of the ones that we had mentioned, and also take medications that might increase their heat sensitivity or dehydration. Pregnant people and newborns, and related to that, sort of young children, as well as all the way up to those who are engaging in youth sports or youth activities outdoors when they may not be acclimated to these high heat exposures. Along those same lines, people who work or exercise outdoors have higher heat exposures and therefore risk. And sort of a key group that we're seeing here in the southern part of the United States is the unhoused, or essentially people who cannot avoid some of these higher heat exposures.
Yeah, could you talk a bit more about the question of, I guess, equity across social class here and income and wealth and how that can affect who is most affected when we see some of these heat waves?
Sure. Income is really important, and more so these days when we know that there's an energy crisis and the price of electricity may be increasing for many people. So we know that the impacts of heat on health are inequitable. We know that people who are more likely to work outdoors are also to be more likely to be lower income and to some extent people of color. One way that I sort of framed to think about this was there is this very rich hotel in Dubai that proposed creating the world's first air conditioning beach. Stated another way, that maybe those with the highest economic resources can afford to adapt even for leisure But those who have limited means to adapt are really bearing the brunt of that, and that's both within the United States and globally.
Sure. I know that I think all of us probably recognize the impact on our electricity bill when we turn the AC on for the summer. It costs money. Certainly costs money if that AC goes down. And Chris, I understand that you have some experience with that growing up and the AC being out on what always seems like the hottest day of the year.
Yes, definitely. I lived in Arizona before I had moved to Wisconsin to do my graduate studies, and as a graduate student, you know, my rent was $250 a month, and which was less than what I would pay during the summer for energy. But living in an apartment like that, almost every summer, without fail, my cooling system would break down during the hottest part of the summer. And one day I did personally experience extreme heat. It's not a life or death experience, but it is unsettling. Your heart starts to beat out of control, and nothing you can do can calm it down, whether that's trying to run your arms underwater or put your head in. Until I took the drastic step of putting my head in the freezer to finally start to calm myself down. And I've had enough of these episodes that I can't say there's much good to have come from it. The only good thing of living in a place where you've had not great infrastructure is that the heat was strong enough to kill the bed bug.
We're talking with Chris Owejo right now, professor at Florida State University who studies extreme heat and the public health response to it. He's with us today to talk about the heat wave happening in Europe and more hot temperatures expected in the U.S. this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the risk of heat waves becoming more common with climate change? Does the heat affect the way you work, your job, where you've chosen to live? What questions do you have about trends in extreme heat, and are there ways you'd like to see us better prepare for it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about extreme heat, what's causing it, the link to climate change, and how it impacts people's health. Chris Owejo with Florida State University stays with us. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. When the temperature rises, do you stay inside? Are you able to stay inside? If not, what impact does it have on your life and your work when it's 90, 100 degrees? And have you ever felt the physical impacts of high heat? Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Chris, earlier we were talking a little bit about some of the things that cities, states, countries can do to adapt to our current reality of frequent heat waves. What are some of the things you've seen around the U.S., maybe at the city level, that hold some promise in keeping people safe from the heat?
Sure. Wisconsin's a bit of a leader in this area. I've had the pleasure of working with. I used to run a program for the state of Florida, and then I would run across my Wisconsin counterparts, Megan Christensen and Colleen Moran, John Myman. But essentially, they've done a variety of things. First is just trying to figure out who is suffering and when these groups are suffering from extreme heat so that one can start to target those interventions. And then perhaps moving a bit to another example, there's a variety of leaders there. There is no sort of gold standard yet, but there's places like New York City that are doing everything from testing out programs where they have volunteers check in with their neighbors during extreme heat episodes. And they have also, during COVID, when their cooling shelters or refuges were shut down, they had disseminated air conditioning units to those, as well as vouchers for the ability to pay for the air conditioning units to a variety of at-risk households.
Sure. So the actual act of having a network of people to check in on neighbors, check in on people living in a community if there is something like a power outage, say.
Yes. And what's wonderful about that, it's not necessarily a high expenditure sort of endeavor, and it builds community. The city of Philadelphia originally created the program, It was called from its Philly Blocks program, and it was originally actually created to target neighborhood crime. So the same thought being that if we are building in these stronger networks, then maybe there's some other potential benefits to building communities and to increase resilience, not just to heat, but to a variety of other hazards or disasters.
And public cooling centers, is that something that we see holding some promise too for this kind of problem?
Great question. I'd say the jury's still out. It is probably the most common preferred method by municipalities to address extreme heat at the moment. There's been some limited work looking at how effective that really is. Some places are running them really well and effectively, but there are some well-known roadblocks to those. For many of them, you might need to have a car to get to them, which is a large challenge. Some of them are not open during the evening times, and et cetera. At this point, I think the more that I am not necessarily, I still applaud those municipalities heading down this path as sort of a first step towards taking further action.
And for people who exercise, or especially young people who play sports outside during the hot weather, that can be especially dangerous. Are there standards out there that you would kind of recommend more places implementing when it comes to practices, games outside?
Yes, absolutely. For the past 30 years or so, and even beyond that, we've heard, unfortunately, stories of mostly professional athletes, but also locally, I'm sure, in your communities as well, of perhaps most commonly football players, but certainly other people who play other sports as well, suddenly falling ill from heat-related illness and dying on the field. So the Corey Stringer Institute, among others, is a leader in this field. They come up with a ranking with how well certain jurisdictions are doing for heat-related guidance. But long story short is we have a pretty clear guidebook on how to prevent heat-related illness in our young athletes. Essentially, you have to acclimate them, following similar protocols that we use for outdoor workers. You'd have to have medical staff who are trained and on the scene and know how to respond to heat-related illness. And you'd have to be willing to reschedule some events if they're going to take place during unsafe conditions.
And Chris, something that we hear about maybe when we talk to our neighbors in the southern U.S. is, oh, it's 105 degrees, but it's a dry heat. And here in Wisconsin, I think we all sort of dread the humidity. Is there a difference when it comes to the danger heat poses when it's drier or when it's more humid?
Sure. Great questions. Both have their challenges. So if in a place like Wisconsin, where you could potentially get weather systems or air masses with both types, a dry heat from the desert or a more moister heat from my neck of the woods, right, both can be harmful. The all else being equal at the same number or temperature number, the moisture heat is more dangerous because it limits the body's ability to sweat, which is its most effective way to cool down. But that being said, I wouldn't scoff at a high dry heat either. As for example, Arizona is the nation's leader in the number of heat-related deaths still, largely due to its dry heat.
And in general, Chris, at all levels of government, whether that's local, whether that's federal, do you think that there's enough action on this issue right now, especially seeing that we're likely going to be experiencing more heat waves in the future, or do we need a little more urgency around this?
Yes, absolutely need more action here. We need to deploy chief heat resilience officers. I've had the pleasure of working with Jane Gilbert in Miami-Dade County and her team as the world's first chief heat resilience officer. We need to have metrics to track what's happening with extreme heat and how we can manage it, and as well as these creative interventions that have win-win potential with some of the other things that are important to us, whether that's stormwater mitigation or greenhouse gas mitigation, or just providing more green or verdant neighborhoods that are provide activity, physical activity space opportunities. So unfortunately, there isn't a dedicated, even a federal agency that is really in charge of extreme heat. NOAA is sort of stepping up to the plate at the moment, But the funding has not been there. And some of the other climate health funding, unfortunately, did not come through with Build Back Better and sort of its related offshoot. So it still is an all-hands-on-deck moment.
And as we wrap up, Chris, what are you watching for next when it comes to either the weather forecast or how we here are doing it, responding to it?
Sure. Right. I know that a lot of this sounds more like doom and gloom, but I do see glimmers of hope. I see glimmers of hope every time there's a new chief heat officer. Hope whenever there's more interest. I think I haven't seen, to be honest, this much interest in my 17 years working on extreme heat on this topic until this year, and I think that's helpful for it. I'm looking for sort of creative, out of the box ways to also to deal and prevent with extreme heat in an equitable fashion, whether that's energy subsidies, whether that's installing a cooling safe space or resilience hub in a low-income housing high-rise unit. There's a variety of things that, to be honest, I don't think we've fully thought of that are needed. So we need you, we need your listeners, we need everyone to bring their creative energies to some of these wicked problems.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Dean.
That was Chris Uejo. He's an associate professor in the College of Social Sciences and Public Policy at Florida State University. He was with us today to talk about the impact of extreme heat, with record heat in Europe and triple-digit temperatures expected in parts of the U.S. next week. Coming up after the news, working in customer service jobs takes a lot of emotional energy. A UW-Milwaukee professor shares her research on the toll it can take and how to make those tough interactions less likely. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin limnologist was awarded the Blue Planet Prize, a global award given out for environmental research. He talks with us about his work and what we can do to protect Wisconsin's freshwater lakes. Now, there's a good chance you've seen, or maybe even been, a server or a cashier dealing with an angry customer or an overwhelming amount of orders. Although that situation is stressful, the employee is still expected to smile and act happy. Our next guest calls that emotional labor and says that wearing a fake customer service smile can be bad for our health, and it can be a factor even for workers who don't directly deal with customers. Sarah Rifergetti is an associate professor of communication at UW-Milwaukee. She studies the connection between emotions and the workplace. She talked with Central Time host Rob Ferret.
The phrase emotional labor, I think people use it in different ways as it's developed over the years. How do you define it, especially when it comes to the workplace?
Yes, actually, Arlie Hochschild came up with this term. She's a sociologist in the 80s when she studied airline stewardesses and bill collectors. And she defines it as the management of feeling to create a publicly observable facial and body display. So in other words, basically, it is when we manufacture emotions for the benefit of commerce.
And if I read your work right, I mean, we think of that as, you know, a cashier or a flight attendant or whatever. It actually comes up in more workplaces than just those public-facing jobs. You've done some work looking at more behind-the-scenes emotional labor.
Yes, absolutely. So when we're working in an organization with other people and we have to fake emotions because we feel like that organization expects or requires those emotions, or perhaps we have to subdue angry or negative emotions, that can be emotional labor as well.
And then you distinguish emotional labor, I think, from emotional work. What's that?
Right. So emotional labor is about the manufacturing of those emotions. And there's surface acting, which is just the outright faking. And there's deep acting, which is when we might reframe a situation or do some perspective taking in order to adjust our emotions and get in line. But there's also emotional work, which is when we walk into a workplace that's laden with emotions, and those emotions are just present there in the workplace. So, for example, if you're a first responder, that work is emotional in and of itself. And then the ways in which you manufacture emotions to do that work would be the emotional labor piece. So they're intertwined, but they're a little bit different.
Okay, so for the emotional labor part, we got to appear or maybe even make ourselves be happy, no matter how we felt when we clocked in. How do we start to figure out if that affects our own emotional or even physical well-being?
Yes. Well, this is something researchers have been working on for a long time. And initially, any faking of emotions was thought to be problematic. However, sometimes when we fake positive emotions, that can actually put us in a better mood. And then emotional contagion is when we catch each other's emotions. And so those positive emotions, like, for example, if you've ever been to a sports arena and people get really excited, those emotions can actually be good for us. So it's not always a negative thing. But when somebody is really negative to us and we have to pretend that we're not affected negatively by those emotions, that's when it can be really taxing for us to put on a smile and to address people who are maybe not as deserving of our positive emotions as we might feel.
Well, we're inviting people to share their personal stories about this emotional labor at 800-642-1234. I'll start with me. I've got a job where I have to, you know, even if I'm feeling tired or unhappy or whatever, I need to sound a particular way on the job. But the good news is I really like my job and it's really easy for me to do that. It's not like a lot of labor for me. Does it matter our attitude toward our job for like how big a lift this is?
Absolutely. So even one of the recommendations we often will give to employers is try to find people who align with the emotions and the value within the organization and the type of work that they're doing, right? So there are probably days where you come in and you're having a hard time. You have the benefit of not being on camera, which helps a lot.
Yeah.
And you've got some back behind the scenes time, right? You might have time during an ad to take a deep breath. So some of those factors of your job also probably help you engage in that emotional labor.
We're talking to Sarah Rifergetti from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Communication there, looking at this idea of emotional labor, when you have to put on a happy face maybe for your job or behave in a certain way, even if you're not feeling it. In some cases, can be bad for you. In some cases, can be pretty good. You could join in with your story, your work experience, maybe at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mika is with us in Wausau. Mika, hello.
Hi.
And what did you want to tell us about?
So I'm just finding it really interesting. I think it's a very important issue to talk about emotional labor, especially on both sides of the spectrum. I feel like, especially with the past couple of years, it's been really rough for everybody, not only in the workplace, but also outside. I've been noticing a lot of managers, especially dealing with, you know, crazy shortages in staffing. And the problem I think that we're running into is that sometimes they can let their frustration come out on the workers who are already there. And then it becomes like this toxic cycle of like, well, now the workers are starting to feel like this brunt, this like lash out. And then all of a sudden it becomes like a whole thing of now we're bringing our personal life into everything. And then it becomes workers and managers playing therapist to each other sometimes when it's like really difficult for everybody involved. And then it becomes kind of like this vicious toxic cycle of all of us dealing with everybody else's problems on top of our own. And sometimes it can get really, really difficult.
Mika, I got to add, this is something it sounds like you've experienced in your own work.
Oh, goodness. Every job that I work at, it always ends up becoming like, you know, it starts off amazingly and then all of a sudden drama happens and it becomes such a like overbearing presence on your workload.
Mika, thank you for sharing it. I hope you end up somewhere where that isn't happening. But Sarah, Mika, not alone, I'm guessing, that downward spiral of toxicity, I think she has encountered.
Absolutely. So just like emotional contagion can share positive emotions, emotional contagion can also affect us in really negative ways. And it's really hard when somebody's telling you to be positive, but they're yelling at you to do that, right? So I can definitely understand what you're saying.
Be happy now.
Yeah, be happy, gosh darn it. But there are things that managers can do, right? So if this cycle is happening, they can acknowledge when employees are really struggling and give them like just a chance to step back into a back room to kind of contain their emotions. The other thing you can do is you can kind of segment your emotions. So for example, news reporters that will go out to fairly graphic scenes will oftentimes segment their emotions and do their job and then acknowledge those emotions later when they have time to unpack and decompress.
Thanks again, Mika, for calling in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, when does this kind of emotional labor start to lead to burnout?
Yeah, so we did a study where we had people do daily diaries for 2 weeks. And what we found was if you're faking your emotions and you're engaging in that surface acting, on a daily basis, it will start to affect your moods and the ways that you're feeling in terms of feeling motivated, enthusiastic, lively. And then even in a period of only 2 weeks, it starts to wear on you in terms of burnout and feeling those negative emotion cycles. So everything that Mika was talking about, it doesn't take that long for that downward cycle to start. And so the trick is trying to catch it as soon as possible so that you can buoy up those emotions once again.
And I think that was the study where you were surveying IT workers, who I don't necessarily think of as public facing. Yeah, they have to help people deal with their problems. But it is, as we were talking about a little earlier, this emotional labor can even happen sort of behind the scenes. Are you fitting into the emotional, preferred mode of your workplace?
Absolutely. So when we walk into a workplace and we feel like other people in the workplace expect us to perform certain emotions, even if it's not in the service industry, but certainly it's more pronounced in the service industry, we sense that and we will perform as those around us expect us to, usually so that we can be good team members and be part of that job. So yeah, even in offices behind the scenes, we can be engaging in emotional labor.
Sarah Rifferjetti is with us, Associate Professor of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. She's sharing her research on emotional labor in the workplace. And you could share maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234. Do you work in a job where you got to come across as happy, even if you're not happy? How easy is that to do in your workplace? How hard is it to do? Is there something that your managers or the business owners can do to help you do that? Call it at 800-642-1234, or do you just genuinely enjoy what you're doing? So it's easy to seem happy because you get happy. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the emotional labor you might perform at work. Sarah Rifferjetti is with us, Associate Professor of Communication at UW-Milwaukee. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. If you ever worked in a restaurant, especially out there dealing with diners, maybe you work in a department store as a sales associate, ever feel like you're acting at your job? Are you doing this emotional labor where you're keeping a happy face on even when you're not happy? Do you find it stressful, or does it come smoothly to you if you support or manage people in that customer service kind of role? What do you do to help them? Call 800-642-1234. And have things gotten tougher over the course of the pandemic for one reason or another? Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah, suppose somebody is a business owner or a manager of people who, you know, deal with the public, with diners at a restaurant, for example. They know they're going to interact in some tough situations sometimes. Do you have thoughts on how they can create a supportive work environment to help that be as unstressful as it can be?
Yeah, so the business managers can have some of that backspace for their employees to decompress. They can also intervene when it seems like emotions are running high and help navigate that situation. Employees can also be really aware of when they're faking emotions, and then they can engage in some deep breathing. They can also think about ways to reframe the interaction. So if somebody is yelling and screaming, rather than seeing that as that person yelling and screaming at them, they can think about maybe that person is having a really bad day and there's something else going on. And how can I generate compassion or a positive emotion to turn this interaction around.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who says maybe this is a result of workers having less power in the workplace compared to previous decades with more unions and labor strikes. What do you think?
Certainly, there is always a power dynamic when somebody feels like they have to perform an emotion for their job. And so that's quite possible. I haven't done extensive research on labor unions, so I can't say that for sure. But I do know that the pandemic has been wearing on us just because of the ongoing uncertainty and unrest. And so that can also heighten our base emotions so that when we walk into interactions, it doesn't take all that much to tip us over. So taking long walks, being aware of our emotions can certainly help us to regulate our emotions a little bit better so that when we do walk into situations and we're interacting with people, we can act more in the ways that we want to act and be the people we want to be.
You mentioned the pandemic and how it may have made things worse. Of course, people in restaurants and stores have also been called on to enforce mask mandates. Those flight attendants we were talking about earlier, them too. I don't know if you're researching this now, but how do you see that affecting this kind of emotional labor and the stress it can bring to people who are working?
The mask is interesting because we can't see people's whole faces. And so it's really hard to read emotions when we're just hearing tone of voice and seeing their eyes. And so that can actually add an added burden in sensing other people's emotions and responding appropriately and also expressing positive emotions. I've been teaching in a mask now for a year and, you know, to try to just smile as much with your eyes as possible takes a lot of effort. And so just trying to navigate and use those nonverbal cues has become even more burdensome when they're taken away with masking. But also enforcing policies that you may or may not agree with can be really challenging. And so again, maybe that gets at some of that power dynamic of when we're doing a lot of things to navigate our own emotions and the emotions of those around us, it places a great deal of a burden on us. And so being aware of where we're feeling and how we're communicating our emotions can really help to open up possibilities to more positive interactions.
That's interesting, the mechanical detail of not seeing the smile. And I can't, they call it smizing, I think, in the model world, where you smile with your eyes. I can't do that. Have you seen other cues or maybe use them as an instructor, like other ways to communicate positive emotion when people can't just see you smiling?
Well, so you just raised your voice. There was a little lilt in your voice, which communicated positive emotions through our vocal tone. And so that's another way that we can communicate our energy and our positivity. The speed of which you talk can also help. So those are small vocal cues, gestures. When you're seeing people, gestures can also communicate emotions. So just thinking really carefully about how can we listen for other vocal cues to pick up on emotions so that we can respond appropriately.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Really appreciate the conversation. And Rob, I appreciate your personal input there on it, because I often wonder about that being the upbeat radio talk host that you are. So anyway, I'm a retired school counselor, but I am still working. And one thing I would want to do is I often, when I talk to kids in classrooms about a positive classroom environment and how that translates eventually into a positive work environment. And I want to put together a program involving music and a message about making an individual commitment to being a positive influence in the classroom, again, with a future focus on a positive work environment eventually. Any input would be appreciated.
Well, Scott, before you go, it sounds like a work in progress, but what kind of things have you tried saying to kids and how have they responded?
Well, yeah, I try to make it an individual choice and that it is a choice. And whatever we bring to the classroom, our individuality, that, you know, regardless of our home environment or our struggles with this or that, we can choose to bring a positive attitude to to our classes and other things that we do in our lives. And so that it's mainly that it's a choice each one of us can make.
Interesting. Scott, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Sarah, any thoughts for Scott on helping create? It sounds like kind of a curriculum for a positive classroom attitude.
Right. Yeah. I can tell that he's really building this community among his students. And what I find really interesting is that he's having this interaction with them, talking to them about the ways in which they're showing up and the ways in which they're showing up that then feed off of each other to build this community. Right. It's really hard to leave things at the door, but when students can walk into a classroom and feel really safe, they're going to learn more because the emotional flooding that they get from negative emotions, if they can turn that off, it will help with them with focus, and it will help them to then generate more positive emotions. And I should say one thing, you know, positive emotions help us with creativity. They help us feel good. They help with something called organizational citizenship behavior. So we're showing up and we're feeling good with each other. But I will say there are benefits to negative emotions as well. So if we're making really tough decisions, it's better not to be in a super positive mood, right? Because we'll slow down, we'll think about details, we'll compare things. So while there is great benefit to positive emotions, there's also benefit to neutral and negative emotions.
Scott, thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Riffergetti from UW-Milwaukee, Associate Professor of Communication there, looking at emotional labor in the workplace and when it can get stressful. And Sarah, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, hey, this is me, I'm doing this emotional labor and it's burning me out. It's a really a problem. I'm not sure if I can keep doing it. Do you have thoughts, kind of a toolkit they can use to like step back, figure out what's going on?
Absolutely. So your body gives you cues all the time. And when your body starts to not feel good, you're gaining weight, you're not sleeping, you're having other issues, then that's a time to really check your emotions, figure out what kind of impact is this work having on me? And do I need to change where I'm sitting or standing or working? Or do I need to change something that I'm doing? And so really just listening to your body for some of those cues, because it tends to come out in our bodies in ways that allow us to recognize there's something going on. And then we can make changes in our lives that will help us be the people that really that we want to be.
Now, you've written a couple few studies on this already. What kind of research either do you have in the works or that you're curious about and you'd like to pursue?
Absolutely. I'm really interested right now in how students get out of difficult, stuck situations. That emotion of feeling really the stuckness, right? Really not able to move forward and progress. And so I'm interested in looking at that emotion and the types of communication messages that people receive that help them be resilient.
Interesting. So when you say students, are you the ones you're working with at the university level or K through 12?
Right now, I'm looking at college students, but certainly the research is applicable beyond college as well in terms of how can we use communication in really productive ways to help people be resilient.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Sarah Riffergetti is an associate professor of communication at UW-Milwaukee. She talked with Rob Ferret about emotional labor, how it affects our well-being, and what we can do to avoid emotional burnout. You can still let us know your story. Do you work in the service industry or is your job public-facing in some way? Do you run into tough situations with customers, with the public? Have they become more common since the pandemic? And when those come about, how do you deal with them? What support do you wish you had from your employer? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, the U.S. Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is holding its next hearing. We expect to learn more about what happened in the hours when former President Donald Trump was silent as the attack on the Capitol unfolded. Join us tomorrow night at 7 o'clock for live NPR coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin summer camp is providing a getaway for young people who have survived burn injuries. We'll talk with the counselors at the camp about how it all got started and the ways they're building community. That and more coming up tomorrow morning after 7 o'clock on The Morning Show. Have you ever been walking outside, came across a woodpecker, and wondered how it's able to hammer its head against a tree all day and not get a concussion? Well, a group of scientists from Cornell University did and got investigating. Woodpeckers hit a tree more than 12,000 times a day, and the prevailing wisdom was that something in their skulls acted as a shock absorber. It turns out that's not the case. That would actually require a lot more energy for the bird. The key? Having a small brain. Because its brain is so tiny, the woodpecker can handle it coming to a complete stop. You can think of a fly slamming into a window and then going on about its day. Having a larger brain is often beneficial in the animal kingdom, but if your daily meals are waiting underneath some tree bark, smaller is better. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.